call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order, and we're going to start this morning with House Bill 2900. It's a work session. Craig.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. We have the engrossed House Bill 2900. We heard the testimony on this. This would create the traffic offense of refusing to take a breath test and sets the fines at least $500 and not more than $1,000.
All right. And do we have any amendments to this bill?
No.
Playing Christmas tunes.
No amendments. Work session.
Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2900 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2900A engrossed to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? No objection. Motion passes. Who wants to carry that?
I'll carry it.
Senator Starr. Carry the bill. Thank you very much. All right, now we're going to move on to Senate Bill 909, Shovel Hearing. Who's entertaining us out there?
It's 909, it's her bill.
Yeah.
Oh. Hey, wait a second, I think I introduced it.
Thank you, Dan.
I move to D6, Senate Bill 909.
Oops. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 909 comes to you from the Oregon Builders Industry Association. It deals with home construction defects or defective systems in a home, and it sets up a system where an owner, to make a claim, would have to give notice of that defect to the contractor or to the supplier if it's a system in the home, a defective system. It then would require the contractor supplier who receives notice from that owner to send secondary notice to other contractors or suppliers. The contractor supplier then can have a visual examination or inspection of the home, which the owner must allow, and also the contractor or suppliers to give a written response to the owner regarding the defect, acknowledging it, or making different citing what to do about it. If they then are given in this written response an offer to correct the defects, that is then taken up by the owner, then that satisfies the owner's claim and also has a notice that is to be given to the homeowner of this procedure. I believe most of you are familiar with this bill from another incarnation of it.
All right. Do you want to say something before we have to?
Yeah, I wish I'd have remembered. This is a reincarnated bill from the closed Senate Business and Labor Committee, and we passed it out to the floor, and Senator Ringo had some concerns, and it was sent back to committee to address his concerns, and it was ready to roll, but as you all know, we didn't reopen. So if Mr. Berry could remind me of the bill number.
Senator Minnis, Senator Walker, that bill number is 2389.
Okay.
From the Senate Business Committee.
Okay, so that is the story behind this bill. And it had come out of our committee on a unanimous vote, and I don't think there was a problem except for the one.
Okay, I have a witness.
Go
ahead. Yes.
So to clarify, this bill was a House bill that was worked in the House. Was it amended in the House?
Senator Minnis, Senator Burdick, the bill was amended in the House and in the Senate to take care of some concerns that Senator Ringo had, and those concerns have also been addressed in the new version, which is 909 in front of you today.
Okay. All right, why don't we go ahead with the just general testimony, if you can.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, just to interject, sorry I'm late. It was at my request that this bill was taken off the Senate floor, and I worked with a trial lawyer named Rick Hubler because there were some defects, and I appreciate the cooperation of the Building Association folks in ironing those out, and unfortunately then the bill got caught up in politics. So I am very much, I feel a little invested in this and making sure that it moves forward because I think it's a reasonable bill.
So can you imagine politics getting in for any of this?
It's just unbelievable.
All right, why don't we go ahead with it?
I will be brief. Scott Berry, representing the Oregon Building Industry Association. And before you today, Senate Bill 909, as has been already explained, is the reincarnation of Senate Bill or House Bill 2389, coming out of the House with no votes and over the Senate, moved to the floor, and then sent back to the Senate Business Committee to fix a technical concern that Senator Ringo had and a discussion that he had had with Legislative Council. We had no concerns over the new amendments. They were put in, and then the bill was then again stuck in the Senate Business Committee. It really comes from a need for our industry to address skyrocketing liability premiums. And not unlike some other industries, our rates have gone up both for the single-family detached and townhomes and condominiums. We've seen from the year 2000, where the single-family detached home roughly paid about $200 towards insurance premiums. In 2003, they now pay about $1,400 per home. Quite a bit more even for the townhomes and condominiums, where they've gone from a couple hundred dollars in 2001. 2 years later, it's $2,460 on average for townhome and condominium. That's a simple the reason for that basically is that those attached housing products are experiencing more claims, and therefore the insurance rates have gone up on those, along with the increasing cost in reinsurance, et cetera, et cetera. The bill, Senate Bill 909 before you, basically sets up a process for a notice to the contractor, and that contractor then notices the substance suppliers. That is followed up by a visual inspection by the general contractor, and then from that point, the general contractor would notify any substance suppliers that they feel would be affected by the defect. And that's important because historically what's happened when we've received a notice of a claim or arbitration or a lawsuit in the building industry, we name every subcontractor and supplier that ever worked on the job site because we're not sure what the claim is for. Unfortunately, those folks who are named substance suppliers often are not part of the problem, and yet still it costs them somewhere in the neighborhood of $5,000 to $10,000 to remove themselves from the process, even though neither party is claiming that they were involved. So one of the side benefits of this bill is that it allows for that inspection and viewing by the general contractor and the subcontractors to determine who may or may not be responsible, and then allows for the general contractor to name fewer subcontractors on each individual claim. That in and of itself will lend itself to lowering insurance premiums. Really, that's all the bill does. It requires that we receive notice, and then it requires that we're allowed to visually inspect and then to inspect by some sort of, if needed, testing. That testing then would have to be repaired and brought back to the its original condition before we left. At that point, it's really up to the consumer then to decide whether they want to move forward. At that point, they can go ahead and file their claim, or they can enter into the arbitration or mediation process really set forth by the bill. And with that, I would be happy to take any questions.
Great. Any questions? There are no questions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Is this bill exactly like the House bill that was when we were working on the language?
Chairman, Senator Ringo, yes, with the exception of the amendment that you had requested, which is Section 6 on page 5. I believe it starts at the end of line 17 and goes to 19. And that really deals with the tolling issue and making sure that if somebody enters this this process, that they are not affected or their ability to file a claim is not affected because they were in this process when the statute of repose ran out.
Thank you.
All right. Lana?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here today representing the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, Idaho. Your testimony reads Ron Manza. He was not able to be here today. PIA, or the short version of the Professional Insurance Agents, has been working on this issue for about 3 years because we have seen the deteriorating vitality of this insurance market for certain classes of construction contractors. As you can see, we've done a lot of work on this issue. We believe that Senate Bill 909 will be helpful in this arena, and we urge your support. Thank you.
All right. Any questions for Ms. Butterfield? All right. Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 909? Not. Work session.
Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move Senate Bill 909 to the Senate floor. Would you pass recommendation?
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 909 to the floor of the Senate. Would you pass recommendation? Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? No objection. Motion passes. Senator Ringo, since you had such a strong interest in this, notwithstanding the fact that I introduced it on behalf of the organization, use one of my last, last priority bill. Would you carry it?
I would.
Thank you very much. Okay. So we've got Senator Ringo carrying the bill. Let's see. What's next on our agenda? Let's do a public hearing on 2783. I don't know if you've got a sign-up bill. You want to introduce the bill?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2783B comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary. And basically what it requires is that when you're getting a driver's license, that you have to give your Social Security number. Also allows the state agency Board of Commission to accept written statements from individuals who has not been issued a Social Security number. So, Chair, members of the committee, this is one of those quasi-federal mandates that's tied to the monies that we receive as it relates to child support. And Lynelle Shankle is here to testify on the bill, and I also believe that she has some material from the federal government concerning our noncompliance.
All right. Lynelle? And others?
We have Social Security bills in this committee.
You do.
Pardon?
All right, Ronell.
For the record, Ronell Shankle with the Department of Justice. As counsel just indicated to you, this is a pseudo-federal mandate bill that we're bringing before you today. It's actually an update. In the 1997 legislative session, you assisted the Department of Justice with passing the child support provisions of welfare reform. One of the mandates and one of the provisions in that act for child support was the license suspension program that we currently are operating successfully in Oregon. There are many details related to those provisions and others. It was, in fact, more than a 200-page bill that the Judiciary Committees passed for us that session. You'll see in my testimony, and a copy is attached, of 42 U.S. Code, Section 666, where it specifically says, in addition to having a license suspension program, the licensing agencies that we interact with need to gather the applicant's Social Security number on the application. The use of the Social Security number by the program is this. If we are proceeding with the tool, the enforcement action, to suspend a license, and we are matching name, date of birth, address, and have a person who has a common name and perhaps a date of birth in a similar month and year, we're going to use the Social Security number as a secondary identifier to make sure we suspend the license of the correct person who owes child support and not someone else. So that's the intent of gathering those numbers. It's not a way for us to collect Social Security numbers. The program would already have those, but it's simply another way to match and make sure that we are dealing with the right customer or obligor. The piece that was missed in the drafting of that 200-page bill was the word drivers. It says that we use the license suspension program with DMV. They, in fact, gather Social Security numbers on their commercial driver's licenses, but we do not have the correct language to gather Social Security numbers on regular licenses and permits. The federal government has sent a notice of intent. You have a copy of that two-page letter in your materials. They have said to us, even though we have a successful program in Oregon and it's in place and operating, we need to add that one word and that one provision in order to have our state plan remain in compliance. You also have a one-page document attached that shows you if our state plan is not in compliance, we stand to lose $85 million in the child support program in Oregon, as well as penalties against the TANF welfare grant. This bill was originally House Bill 2112, which was introduced by the Attorney General. It was redrafted, as counsel said, through the Judiciary Committee in order to be amended. Because of the topic, we had a very narrow relating clause and couldn't get all of the amendments in we need. The bill you have before you today has two significant amendments added. In House Judiciary Committee, provisions were added to relate to the disclosure of information by Department of Transportation. In other words, to put a handle on what they will do with the Social Security numbers if they get a public records request. And Kelly Taylor is here to answer any questions about those provisions of the bill. The piece that was amended while this bill was in Ways and Means was to add language and a provision to tell us what to do if an applicant comes in to get a license and does not have a Social Security number. And the shorter answer is that they will be able to sign a statement saying that they don't have a Social Security number. So we have taken care of all the issues that we are aware of with our partners. We need to have this bill pass in order to be in compliance. The federal government has basically been pending our hearing and watching the status of this bill as it moved through the process. It's already been in Ways and Means so that they could look at the fiscal impact on the Department of Transportation. And it's here before you today with no further amendments and our request that it be passed to bring us into compliance.
Okay, Kelly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Tater, Department of Transportation. I don't have any testimony to offer. I came to the table with Ronell in case you had any questions about our process.
All right. I do think it's interesting we have a letter from the Department of Human Services here. It's my impression that the Department of Human Services couldn't count resources if their life depended on it. And their budget's an absolute nightmare. I don't think they know where their money's at. So, I mean, I don't have a lot of faith in the Department of Resources knowing what the actual fiscal impact is based on the moving target and the lack of justification for their growing fiscal implications for the Oregon Health Plan. I think they're just either confused or incompetent on that. With that, I don't know if anybody has a particular interest in this.
Mr. Chair, I decided that I'd just work my Social Security issue in the other bill we currently have pending in our committee that I promise I'll be done with it soon. So I don't have a problem. This is a federal deal, and they've taken precautions to protect Social Security numbers, and that was what's important.
And that's what you like, right?
Yes.
All right. Well, now that I've said my pithy comments about the Department of Human Resources, meaning every word, we're going to go into work session.
Chairman, I move House Bill 2783 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2783 before the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? None. Motion passes. Who wants to carry this puppy? Actually, I think we should carry this.
Senator
Walker, you can do a diatribe on Social Security.
Social Security? I'd be happy to.
Too bad we can't amend this floor.
We can. You can do that.
Well, I'm still working on the other one. Don't give up on me yet.
All right. Don't give up on you yet.
No.
What other exciting legislation do we have in front of us?
The most exciting one.
904. It's a work session, actually, but let's see where we are in this thing.
Chairman, the committee, Senate Bill 904, comes from the Joint Committee on Ways and Means and relates to dispute resolution that would do away with the Dispute Resolution Commission. And the original bill would transfer its function to the Attorney General's Office, the Department of Justice. You have the dash one set of amendments, which are technical changes to that, and you also have the dash two amendments, which instead of sending it to the Department of Justice, would send it to the Hatfield School of Government.
All right. Dash one are technical, to the Hatfield. Okay, and Senator Walker, I think you had some folks that...
I did, and
going to be here to talk.
Jane Gordon was in the room, and she disappeared. I sent her off in search of President Frohnmayer.
What, do you want to do a research, or a little recess so we can find her?
I would appreciate that. I think she was aware that we were going to be...
5-minute recess. You can go find those who want to talk to us. Yes, sir.
With Jane Gordon.
With whomever wants to come, and this is kind of Vicki Walker's show here, so.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just explain to other members of the committee, we heard this issue on Friday when you were attending to other duties, and the issues that came up, we all, I think, felt that the Dispute Resolution Commission is a valuable program and we don't want to lose it, and there was some discussion about partnering with University of Oregon or the Hatfield School in Portland, and so Jane Gordon and President Frohnmayer are here to talk about the ULO's commitment, and Jane has an interesting idea that I think we should talk about partnering this program with the Hatfield Center, and I think Greg Wolf is here to discuss that, and Mike Niemeyer, who's the executive director of the program. So I would like to get President Frohnmayer, because I know he's here testifying on something else today.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Frohnmeyer, President of the University of Oregon. I very much appreciate, Mr. Chairman, your taking me out of order, and I do have testimony to give in the Ways and Means Committee in a few moments, but I appreciate the opportunity to make a general overview of a statement, a couple of points, and I hope that you will hear the message brought to you by my colleague, Dean Jane Gordon, who is here from the University of Oregon School of Law. I suppose I should begin a discussion about the Dispute Resolution Center and the process of dispute resolution by saying we are not here to try to begin a dispute, that we come in the nature of collaboration. We come offering a program and offering wider visibility for a program that has truly national and very significant representation, reputation, and that this is a program that, because of the fiscal problems that have affected the statewide program, may be a very useful and happy marriage and collaboration among various institutions of higher education. I would not be here to create a dispute between or among institutions of higher education. If there are issues about the appropriateness of jurisdiction, those are ones for this committee to resolve, certainly not for us to stir the pot. But I really think there's value added in what Dean Gordon will present to you today, value added in a collaboration with the Hatfield School at Portland State University. And I think that the proposal that will be brought to you by Dean Gordon in a few minutes will show ways in which we can add value to a function which I think you all know is desperately needed in this society today, which is ways to resolve disputes on a low-cost basis without the involvement of the judicial system in a formal way, at a time when everyone's expenses are threatened and stretched to the limit. So what I would ask for you to do is, as you consider this issue, to look carefully at the possibility of amendments which Senator Walker may be introducing to this committee, to allow you time to reflect on the best possible deployment of resources in the field of dispute resolution, to allow the participation of a program, I'm speaking now specifically of the University of Oregon, which actually uses this as a way of training students and which has a track record. So we're not talking pie in the sky. We're not talking about something that's never been done before. We're talking about something that has saved people money, has trained students in a responsible and mature way to deal with the resolution of disputes, which in terms of its impact per dollar is very, very cost effective, and which would show the possibility of having two of the major public institutions of the state involved in a meaningful collaboration that would have, and could have at least, a statewide impact on this very important area of resolving disputes. Recognizing, of course, the fiscal realities that with the State Commission no longer being able to do what you and your predecessors wanted it to do, that the function nonetheless is important, maybe even essential for our society. So it would be our hope that you would give a full and fair consideration to a proposal that would allow the collaboration among our two institutions in areas that desperately need this service. And I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the chance to take me out of order. Very much appreciate your courtesy, and I would very much appreciate your willingness to hear the message that Dean Jane Gordon brings you today.
Mr. President, thank you very much for your comments. I appreciate that, and good luck in Ways and Means.
Thank you, Senator.
All right, Ms. Gordon.
Thanks. Well, first, I don't want to spend a lot of time. If you've had a chance to read the letter that I sent yesterday by fax and by email, in it I talk about our program and the kinds of things that our program does in training students, educating students, and also involving the mediation dispute resolution community and has for a number of years. And I think that we have a huge amount of strength in this area and can really add to the commission work in ways that, you know, the money that they've had it would benefit and support the money that they have and can have in the future. We're interested in the program, as you heard last Friday, and we're also interested if it makes the most sense in collaborating with the Hatfield School, because it really would be a possible way of utilizing, you know, scarce resources in the state at this time to make the most of what we have. And so the proposal that I have, and you know, it really could be a different kind of proposal. I guess I would really ask that the Senate ask us to work with the Hatfield School to come up with the best proposal. The proposal I suggest in here might be one of our jointly having oversight about over the commission work, or whatever it's called in the end, and particularly having leadership and the community mediation angle from the law school, and leadership from relative to public policy from the Hatfield School. And I think that we could work together so that both schools could also benefit and participate in the other's programs and bring a lot of value that way. But I think, you know, probably dividing the leadership along the grounds of a community mediation public policy way might be a good way. There might be there probably are others and might be better ways of doing it. I think I'm so happy that this week we're talking about ways to enhance the work of dispute resolution in the state as opposed to abolishing it. And I guess I would ask that the committee look at slowing down the process just a bit to have some chance to talk about the best way to do that. If we have a week to talk about it or a few days to talk about it and have an amendment that makes sense for the state, that would really be my suggestion. There was a hand.
Question, Senator Farrelly.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you heard my read my suggestion earlier that the institutions interested in taking over this association be given the challenge of mediating which of them should have the program as a test of their capacity. Probably not a good idea.
Well, I would just echo what President Frohmeyer said, which is that we really aren't here to cause a dispute or a conflict or to lose the baby in the middle of all of this. We really do want to come up with the best solution. And we suggested one that we really think would work the best for the programs and really enhance what they've been trying to do all of these years and into the future. So I agree. I think we could sit down and talk about it and try to come up with a great solution to propose to you.
And Mr. Chairman, I have a theory I'd like to share with the community just to see if that's
theoretical discussion.
Theory.
Certainly there are five institutions, I think, that are very well capable of achieving the goal of maintaining this program. They either operate law schools in the state of Oregon or have dispute resolution programs currently. Portland State University, the Hatfield School, Lewis and Clark with the law school there, Willamette University, and University of Oregon. Did I leave anybody out? The inclination that I would have would be to look very hard at those institutions that are publicly funded and those institutions that are privately funded. And in that instance, you might presume that the publicly funded institutions may do arbitration between state agencies and between agencies and applicants or permittees or others that may try to access the dispute resolution program. And in that case, it might be a perceived conflict of interest for a publicly funded institution to be making a decision on a general fund agency. And so my strong inclination would be to look at the private institutions that either have a law school or operate a dispute resolution program. So my inclination would be to look hard at Willamette University or Lewis and Clark.
Just a point of information, that this program doesn't provide arbitration that makes decisions. Just it's providing mediation services where the disputants make their own decisions. So just a point of information.
And I appreciate the point. It's an important point. I think perception by the public and by those that might access arbitration is critical. So absolute impartiality is probably be critical.
Mm-hmm.
And I would wonder if folks wouldn't think that a publicly funded institution might have a built-in bias.
Again, I think the way that it's designed is that the public institution is training mediators, again, who are helping disputants come to their own resolution. So they're providing neutrals. And we haven't found that to be a bias. Our students work in small claims court and in other places, and students at PSU, I'm sure, work at other places. So I haven't seen that. It's an interesting thing angle to explore, certainly.
All right. Thank you. Any other theoretical discussions, comments, or political speeches?
I guess I would just like to ask, and I'll be asking pretty much everyone who gets up here. And one of the issue, I mean, this bill wouldn't even be before us if we weren't in a budget crisis. There's no dissatisfaction I've ever been aware of with the commission and its activities. It has just a tremendous amount of support. So the budget issue is really what's driving this. And so one of the things I want to look at is, how can we get the most for the limited dollars that we're going to be sending wherever it goes, if it's an academic setting? So I want to find out from you how you could leverage the funds at the University of Oregon, whether you could put more funds in, you know, what, how would that work from a budget standpoint?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. I think that is extremely pertinent. I think it's twofold. First of all, in terms of funding, our program has me as a director and associate director and a program administrator and space and all of those kinds of things. Certainly, this would also be coming with some money for money for administration, as I understand it. The value that's added in terms of the structure of the law school and the ADR program would certainly be there to benefit this program. In addition, I think the most fascinating and important part of what we have to offer are the students. And we have a huge, huge, huge interest among our student body about relative to dispute resolution.
You're talking about the law school.
The law school at this point. However, we also do work with both graduate students and undergraduates and are increasing that work. So those students also do come, and we teach undergraduates in dispute resolution who are also very interested. There's just a very strong feeling that the future of the country and of our state is in figuring out a way to peacefully resolve disputes, and surprisingly it is happening at a law school. So we have 100 students in our student organization who won chapter of the year from the ABA who are looking for service opportunities. We train 40 students a year to be mediators who are looking to mediate and participate and help community programs. They are aching for ways to be of assistance. I can just imagine them. I know that they would be very, very helpful. So I think there's the capital commitment in terms of making sure that there's appropriate support in our organization, in our administration, and then there's also this incredible human capital that I just think would be add incredible value, and that's an overstated term, but really, really would.
And a follow-up question. Your memo proposes as one alternative, and you've made it very clear that's only one, and we could do it in many different ways, that the community function could be based at the U of O and the policy function at the Hatfield School, which has a policy infrastructure. If that were to result dividing like that into a lesser amount of money that is available now for community dispute resolutions, would that be something that could be accommodated?
Well, I think we'd have to look at what the numbers are. I mean, it doesn't make sense to do something that isn't funded appropriately. I mean, we would have to look at what the numbers are to make sure that there is support for the community programs the way there has been, and those programs have the money to do the work that they're doing throughout the state. Obviously, we'd have to look very clearly at that. I just want to say that, you know, the U of O also does have a very strong public policy group, and we would be appropriate for that part as well. Just came here, as Senator Farrelly is joking, with an olive branch to say, let's not fight about where it should go. Let's try to make the most of what we have to offer and work together. So I think that both programs really need strong support, and I think they can get it with a woven fabric from both institutions. I also think that we could do it alone if that was what the committee decided.
Thank you. Any other questions from Senator Walker?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Burdick covered the questions that I was going to ask. And Ms. Gordon, I'm glad you brought that out about your students getting chapter of the year, and you've got 100 students, and then you train 40 each year. I think that's really instructive. The one thing that I'm concerned about, and I think members of the committee are too, and it's appropriate you make us aware of the fact that the commission is the work of the commission is in two areas, according to the statute, and it's community mediation and public policy. So what I want to be, if we do share it between these two schools or other schools, as Senator Farrelly has thrown in mm-hmm. the ring today, I just want to make sure that we can adequately fund both elements of the program, and that may be a restructuring of the commission. You know, I don't believe that necessary. Is it necessary that the same staff is going to transfer over? Is it necessary that they're going to transfer over the same salary rate? I mean, these are all things that
right.
it's time to take a look at
right.
and
right.
view. But I think when we can look at that in that structure, we can make sure that we preserve enough funds for each segment of the program if we do split that. And I believe that's your goal.
Right. That would be the goal. I think, you know, we do know the pot of money is the filing fee that is collected, and there's an estimate of what that would be. And the question is, how do we adequately fund both of these programs and bring some of the money back into the judiciary, which was what the point of Ways and Means wanted. So I think there's a way to do that that has been discussed last Friday, and I think is in some of the testimony that, or you know, even in your own amendment. I think that that's the question of how to do that, and I do think it's very possible.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just finally wanted to state that that her testimony, Ms. Gordon's testimony last Friday, was that she thought the law school would be an appropriate place to lodge the program, and that she thought that there was probably support. So I think now we have that support, and I'd be very interested in hearing from Portland State as to their how they could plug into the program.
All right.
I think.
Council.
Chair, members of the committee, I've heard a lot of discussion about mediation as it relates to state. In RS-36-245, the Dispute Resolution Commission, the Department of Justice, the Oregon Department of Administrative Services, and the governor shall collaborate to increase the use of alternative dispute resolution. When you go to page 1 of the bill, line 4, repealing, and what I was just citing was 36-245, it repeals 36-245. My understanding of the issues as it relates to Ways and Means that they're intending to reduce from 6 to 2 FTEs. And the bill as originally drafted by Ways and Means does away with that particular provision. So that would have to be amended if we're going to keep that particular provision. That would have to be taken out. And then I also heard discussion about transfer employees, the -2 amendments, and I believe it's in the original bill too. Notwithstanding RS-236-605, I'm reading from page 2 of the amendments, 236-640, employees of the Dispute Resolution Commission are not to be transferred to the Hatfield School of Government. Then it goes on to say the director of the Hatfield School of Government may select employees who will assist the Hatfield School of Government performance of its duties. So there's no automatic transfer or over of employees.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. Who should I bring up? Greg Wolf, are you representing Portland State University? Are there others you'd like to bring up?
I think I'm in.
Yep. Dr. Bernstein is not available.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm pleased to be here today to discuss the strengths of Portland State University in terms of being a place to house the dispute resolution program. I think the work that is going on at the Hatfield School of Government offers some unique strengths, I think, to the program. I just want to mention a few of the resources that exist there. There's a Institute for Nonprofit Management that I think would be very useful to some of the community programs in carrying out their missions. Have the Executive Leadership Institute there, which is very focused on civic capacity building. There's a tribal institute there headed by former Congresswoman Elizabeth First. There's a also a public safety program in the school that deals with a variety of public safety issues, including community issues. And the National Policy Consensus Center is there, which I direct, and that is a program, actually a national program, that is designed to help states develop dispute resolution programs and maintain them over time. So I think we have some resources there that are particularly useful. In addition to that, at Portland State University, you have a master's program in dispute resolution that also has a full complement of students that are looking for opportunities to work with communities around the state. So I just wanted to mention those particular resources that I think would be useful to the program, and just express Director Ron Tammond's interest in the program, and also President Bernstein's commitment to the program as well, and support for the -2 amendments. In addition to that, I just want to mention that we are very willing to work in cooperation, however you want to describe it, with the other institutions. I personally think that the U of O Law School program is an excellent program, and would be I think we would be remiss in not working with it should the Hatfield School end up with this program. Also at Willamette University, there's a very fine dispute resolution program there. There's great programs at Oregon State University with respect to water issues that are focused on conflict resolution. Actually has a worldwide reputation for doing that that work. So I think there's a lot of resources throughout the system that we would be very interested in collaborating with and integrating into the program. And with that, I guess I'll just answer your questions. I do think that, and Debbie Murdoch reminded me that we have some joint programs with Lewis and Clark University as well. So I think we stand ready to try to leverage as many resources as we can in the entire public and private university systems.
All right. Greg, any questions for Mr. Wolf?
No, Mr. Chairman. What kind of an infrastructure do you have at the Hatfield School to accommodate the functions of this program?
Well, Chairman, Senator Burdick, the resources that are there are the ones that I mentioned, and I think that the trick here is to try to integrate some existing programs with the opportunity that's presented by this proposal. And so I think it would the effort would be to try to integrate some of the work that is going on, for example, in the nonprofit institute with the community programs. With respect to the program at the National Policy Consensus Center, we would try to integrate the work we're doing there with the public policy program. So I think the effort would be to try to find ways, creative ways, to integrate those programs into the existing programs. We don't have a lot of extra money, I think, as any institution is facing those challenges right now. And we couldn't take this program on without some additional administrative resource.
And Mr. Chairman, if the proposal were to be the one where the community dispute resolution program, say, went to Eugene and was based out of the law school, and the policy program, now the initial proposals we have do not fund the policy function, and that is a mistake that I would hope this committee would correct. But assuming that we can provide the adequate level of funding for the policy function, you said that you work well with the other institutions. Would that be something that would be doable from your standpoint?
Chairman, Senator Burdick, we would do whatever this committee asks us to do. And if you ask us to go back and work out some arrangements with those other institutions, we'd be happy to explore that with them.
Thank you. And could you elaborate a little bit? He's gone now. But the working relationship with Lewis and Clark that you have, they do have a law school there.
Senator Burdick, I guess I'd ask Debbie Murdoch to answer that, the specifics of that question. I'm not familiar with the details of the joint partnership that exists.
Senator Burdick, for the record, my name is Debbie Murdoch. I work at Portland State University. Our relationship with Lewis and Clark has evolved over the years. We acquired their Master's in Public Administration program. So the faculty that once worked at Lewis and Clark are now part of the Hatfield School of Government. In addition, we're embarking on a partnership with the law school and our school of business around business support and entrepreneurial development. So we work closely with them in a variety of ways, but those are two examples.
Thank you. And then either one of you, Ms. Gordon talked about the students that they had and that they trained, I believe it was trained 40 mediators mm-hmm. a year. What is your student base like for the mediation, the volunteer mediation activity?
Senator Burdick, I believe it's comparable in size to the U of O program, and it's a master's program at Portland State University. In addition to that, the students that exist in the Hatfield School of Government and in the urban and public policy school is also fairly significant, and they're focused on public policy issues primarily, and they too are looking for opportunities to integrate and do work at a community level.
Chairman and Senator Burdick, I would just add, again, Debbie Murdoch, that it's my understanding that the Master's in Conflict Resolution program has about 150, 170 students. They're planning to enroll students this fall. And again, as Greg said, we in the College of Urban and Public Affairs, we have political science students, administration of justice students, Master's in Urban Planning students, and a variety of students who are engaged in community activities throughout the campus as part of our capstone project, which is a mandatory program for all graduating seniors to work in the community.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. I just don't think things like urban planning intersect that much with the dispute resolution. And I suppose it could if that was the nature of the dispute. But, I mean, what do you see that the typical dispute that might be handled through alternative dispute resolution? What would be the subject matter?
Chairman, Senator Ringo, there are a wide variety of disputes that are handled through the public policy program, all the way from mineral and aggregate siting cases to development proposals to social service issues, health care issues. There's just the public policy program deals with the whole gamut of public policy disputes.
Your current public policy program?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And then what do you see the typical dispute being that would be handled by the dispute resolution?
Senator Ringo, as I think a previous speaker indicated, there's a community program, which is really operates at the community level with volunteer mediators in large part, working on very local, very neighborhood sort of oriented disputes, and then there's a public policy program that works with the larger public policy cases that the state agencies often find themselves embroiled in. So those are the two types of disputes, and the current program deals with both of those. And as Senator Burdick indicated earlier, there's some question about whether or not there's enough funding to do both of those things in the current bill.
The question, Debbie. Is there an interest among the Portland business community in dispute resolution?
Chairman and Senate, I have not had a conversation with the business community about this, the Oregon Business Council or the general community, but Greg, I think, works more closely with that.
Chairman, the business community, I guess the way I'd express their interest is their support for the community solutions team, for the Oregon Solutions Program. Those are programs that have a dispute resolution element to them, so I really talk about integrating agency and public-private work in community-based problems. And they're actually serving on the steering committee for a couple of those programs right now.
And, Chairman, in terms of leveraging resources, it's my understanding that the conflict resolution program has received donations from business leaders in the community. So I think the private donation, the philanthropic function, is strong there.
All right.
Question.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you. Could you address, either one of you, the concern Senator Ferrioli had about a potential conflict of interest if this was housed in a public institution versus a private institution?
Senator Minnis, Senator Walker, the program really strives to create a neutral place for people to come to resolve problems, and oftentimes private mediators are hired to mediate cases that need a neutral, and oftentimes the state is a party to these cases, and for that reason the best practices of dispute resolution are very focused on neutrality, and so that's a part of the best practices that are used in the resolution of all these cases.
And then I might suggest that there's quite a bit of money. I think the current budget for the Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission is 30% goes to administrative costs, but the discussion was reducing it to two FTEs, which certainly I don't think that much money needs to go to the administrative cost. So I think we could find some ways to transfer more money into the policy and the community element there. So I think there's some work that we can do here.
All right, there are a few other people we'd want to hear from, I think, unless they don't want to talk. We've got Donna Silverberg, mm-hmm. Oregon Mediation Association. Mm-hmm.
Chair Minnis and members of the committee. Thank you again for hearing from us today. My name is Donna Silverberg. I'm the president of the Oregon Mediation Association. And I want to begin by thanking you for your willingness to consider an alternative approach to funding the functions that are currently served by the Dispute Resolution Commission. I've reviewed the Dash 2 amendments and briefly the Dash 1 amendments. And generally, I need to go on the record again for my organization to say that we're not in favor of abolishing the commission. If there were some way to perhaps use the suggestion that was made last week, of suspending the commission itself, you know, take the function and move it where it needs to go, but suspend the commission for another time when there might be appropriate funds that would support that. The commission form of governance here in Oregon is an important one. It keeps citizens involved in the participation of the implementation of the policies that you make. And if you were to suspend the commission for the time being while continuing its functions, then perhaps some other time we'd be able to bring that back into play. We are in favor of moving the function of the commission to an institute of higher education as an important opportunity to leverage the resources and energy that you've heard folks talk about today to continue to build capacity and to evaluate the effectiveness of dispute resolution programs on a statewide basis. We've got some specific amendments to the Dash 2 amendments that you have. In Section 9, we would suggest replacing Director of the Dispute Resolution Commission with Director, and then leaving the language that is currently in the statute in place and adding a Section 4 that would address issues that would allow for a swifter resolution of problems that have involved fraud or other more serious types of issues, but maintaining in that section the dispute resolution techniques that it speaks to, which is really what Chapter 36 is all about, encouraging state agencies and state functions to first negotiate and then use mediation or arbitration as other ways of resolving those conflicts. And that's the only place in this statute that gives state agencies, not just this one, but other state agencies, the message that is a way to approach the kinds of issues that they're dealing with. In Section 10, with the move to a higher education institution, we would ask that instead of saying may establish an advisory committee, that you replace that with shall establish an advisory committee. With the suspension or the abolishing of the Dispute Resolution Commission, it would be very important to have folks who understand these kinds of practices, who understand the history of the state's involvement in the Dispute Resolution Commission work, to be integrated with the programs at the higher education area. I know that they are committed to these sorts of practices at both of the institutions you've heard from so far. I think it would be a beneficial addition to have folks who actually practice these kinds of techniques out in the field, working with them to develop the implementation strategy of your policies that you make. And then in Section 12, we would recommend continuing with the allocation process that you have currently in place, which uses a percentage of the collected fees as opposed to setting dollar amounts. And our suggestion here is that 60% of the funds that are collected go to the community programs because of the valuable service that they provide to our community statewide, that 25% of the funds be used for the administration purposes and also for the state agency public policy program work, and then 15% of those funds going to the Judicial Department to fund their mediation and arbitration. I do want to address a comment that was made just a little bit earlier about changing some of the funding numbers around, and I just want to make certain that you understand that in the broad discussions that we were convening through this legislative process and session with folks from a wide range of areas, it was a very clear message that the Community Dispute Resolution Program should at least remain whole in the funding that they have received. So I want to urge you as you're playing with those numbers and changing around percentages that you aim for at least the 50% number that they have now or higher, moving to the 60% that we've suggested here. And then at Section 25, replace Dispute Resolution Commission with Director of the Program. That particular paragraph in Section 25 set up an advisory or a steering committee that consists of the Department of Justice, the Department of Administrative Services, the Governor's Office, and in the past, the Dispute Resolution Commission, to look at ways to improve the dispute resolution functions and techniques that are used by state agencies. And I think it would be very important for whatever program gets this function that they be part, very active part of those conversations. So add that director language in there. And in conclusion, I just want to thank you again for having heard us last week, giving us the opportunity to speak again today, and for giving us the opportunity to make some suggestions to you about different ways that we might be able to maintain these services that are so important to the citizens of our state.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Senator Burdick.
On your proposed allocation of the funds, 60% for community dispute, 25% for administrative. Where is the policy function located? Is that in the 25%?
It's in the 25%. As the Dash 2 amendments were written, it has it speaks there of administration of both the Chapter 36 requirements, which is the funding to the community dispute resolution programs, and also for the responsibilities as laid out under 183.502, and that is the state agency component. So that would be a combination there in Section 2 or subsection 2 of Section 12 of the Dash 2 amendments. So there is some funding capabilities in that subsection 2 for the public policy program.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, if right now, as I understand, it's 50% for the community dispute resolution program. So if you took that 60 down to 50 and made 35% for the other functions, that would still leave the community.
It would leave the community programs whole with the money they're receiving today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Herbelberg, going to your amendments on Section 9 on the Dash 2 amendments, isn't that what you're suggesting we change?
Yes, I left my Dash 2 on my chair.
And as amended, we're taking out the language the Director of the Dispute Resolution Commission, replacing it with the Director of the Mark Hatfield School of Government. And you're suggesting that we... I'm not following your suggestion.
Oh, thank you very much. The suggestion at 9, if you look at the Dash 2 amendments...
page 7, line 15?
Line 24, actually. So if we go down to line 24, it has deleted sections 2 and 3. Which sets out the negotiation, the need for negotiation and mediation to occur if there is some conflict with the administration or potential administration of a community dispute resolution program. So my suggestion is that that stay in place, okay. and the added language at line 21 through 23, which suggests that you can just swiftly move to the suspension or termination of funding, that be put into a section 4, but primarily for issues where there's really good reason to believe that there is fraud or misappropriation of funds. So that in those cases you can suspend the funding, but in other cases where you just have a problem with the way a director might be doing something, you just don't take that money away without first negotiating with them and perhaps providing an opportunity to mediate. And again, the reason that this is even remotely important to us is that this is the statute in the ORSs that speaks about dispute resolution and sets up kind of the model and the symbolic language to other agencies and to citizens of the state of how it is that we go about trying to resolve conflict. So it's an important educational piece that's been part of this statute.
Chair, members of the committee, just a couple further questions. So what you want us to do is remove the brackets and put the language
yes.
back in. One further question, as it relates to Section 10, are you really wanting, it says currently, to aid and advise the Mark Hatfield School of Government in performance of its functions, the director of the Mark Hatfield School of Government may establish such advisory and technical and the plural committees. So I would assume what you would want is that they shall have an advisory committee and may have additional committees as needed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you very much.
All right. Senator Ringo.
few could only do one function, the urban, public policy function, or the community dispute resolution, which would it be?
I think that the direction my board and the folks who I represent would take would be to fund the community programs at this point. We do not have enough low-cost alternatives to folks out there for resolving their conflicts, and the community programs are the way to do that. And now, and I should confess, this causes me personal pain to even suggest that, as I was the public policy program coordinator for the state of Oregon for 5 years from 1994 to 99. So it's a program that is near and dear to my heart, and I think that if we could maintain the community function, that our organization, in conjunction with those community programs, could work with whomever it is we need to work with to try and re-engage the public policy aspects. I do think that both, that the two-pronged approach is very important for the state, because I think it sends a very strong message to state agencies if you have some sort of funding and some sort of commitment to the public policy program as a message to state agencies that they really do need to try and find creative and innovative ways to solve their problems. So both is my answer.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm just concerned, you know, in these ongoing budget discussions we have, lots of agencies can talk about the problems of thinning the soup, so that pretty soon you've pared things down too much to be effective. And it seems to me that you've got a huge task. You're trying to do an awful lot without much in the way of resources. And I'm just concerned that, it would be better if you maintained a focus and you would be more effective at what you did. And that by doing too much, you'll be less effective on all sides.
Chairman and Senator Ringo, when we were looking and having the discussions about how you could reduce the funding and what would be the primary functions, there was a consensus around this notion of 2.5 FTE. And I think the reason that we feel this way is that the commission staff was 2.5 for a number of years, and they were able to be effective at doing the community programs, providing the grants to the community programs, because the community programs are the ones that do the work in the communities, not the Dispute Resolution Commission. The commission provides the funding to those programs and technical assistance. I think we heard someone last week say that they call the office almost every day for some input on ideas. But that could still happen. That interface could still happen. And there would need to probably be a reduction in the scope of what the public policy program does. Years ago, we just focused on natural resource issues. In the last couple of years, last 5 years, we were able, because we had the financial resources of the state, to expand that, to do more in human resources and community development, and what else would you, general government services. So you could refocus on an area of conflicts in the state that are most troubling to the legislature and to the citizens of the state, and then eventually hope to build that program back up again.
Right.
Okay.
From a mediation standpoint, are you familiar with programs at Portland State and the University of Oregon?
I am familiar with those. I'm also familiar with programs at Merrillhurst and Southern Oregon University and Lewis and Clark and Willamette. There are a lot of good programs in the state.
Well, since Portland State and UofO are the ones that have, stepped forward and expressed an interest, can you help us understand the differences of what they have to offer?
I think that they have well represented what it is that they have to offer at this point. I think both are excellent institutions that seem to have a very good, strong commitment to these ideals. And my organization has asked me to stay neutral on the issue and leave that tough decision to all of you. And so I can say that both institutions are fine institutions and have commitment to conflict resolution services.
I had one question, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Silverberg, yesterday Mr. Niemeyer came to me with some amendments that I was going to draft, and I changed my mind because we needed to work out some more issues today. Had he run those by you to get your buy-off on those potential amendments?
Chairman, Senator Walker, unfortunately, yesterday I actually was mediating for the day, and okay. I was unable to look at those until late in the day. He and I had spoken the day before and talked about some concepts, and I have seen the testimony that he has today, and I know that we were able to work through any issues that we may have had, and we're in line at this point.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that. Actually, some of the changes that you have are different from what he proposes today. Well, it was my understanding in looking at his testimony. But if you are all in agreement, I'm happy. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Mike Niemeyer. Michael Niemeyer.
Chair Menas, Senators, for the record, my name is Mike Niemeyer. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission. I'm happy to be here today. Let me just present some recommended, suggested amendments to the Dash 2, and then be responsive to your questions in any way that I can. And for Senator Walker, I think that as far as what I've got here, I think that Donna Silverberg and I have talked about these things, and we are on the same page on these. So
okay.
If not, I'd be happy to have her come back and comment where we differ. But let me say on the issue of moving to higher ed, several months ago, you know, I did approach each of the schools to talk about the whether they would be interested in our program affiliating, and it's actually been quite an exciting discussion about the opportunities that exist and seeing the response there. And it's also affirming that these schools see some value in this program and are here today to offer opportunities for us to affiliate with them. My first suggestion, I have some written comments here in front of you, is to give the program some kind of identity or name. So I would recommend something along the lines of the Oregon Dispute Resolution Program as something to use to be used in conjunction with references to the Mark Hatfield School of Government. To continue to have some kind of identity. The program at this point does have a national reputation. It would be nice to have something to hang that on in the future here. Similar to Donna Silverberg's suggestions, I recommend use of percentages rather than dollar amounts. Partly, I think this is a covenant between local communities where these fees are collected. There's a surcharge in court fees. A percentage makes it pretty clear if I'm paying a $7 fee. I know policy-wise, you know, what percentage of my money is being used where. And the 60%, I think, sends a message that most of that money should go back to the local communities where that was collected to support those volunteer community dispute resolution programs. I have a suggestion here of 25% for administrative costs. Let me just note that that's not just staff and paper clips, but the administrative portion of this budget traditionally pays for statewide projects. So in addition to the money dedicated to county programs, that there is some money there to do things like, you know, pay for a project, maybe to fund a manual for mediation training or something that would benefit all programs. So there's program money in that 25%, and that represents half of what we're operating with now.
And Mr. Chairman,
Senator Burke,
in that 25% in your proposal, is that the same as Ms. Silverberg's proposal that statewide policy, the state agency function would fall in that 25%?
Yes.
Policy function. Thank you.
In addition, I have some other suggestions here. I won't go through all of these in detail, but effectively, number five of mine here brings back some of the provisions in the original statute that provide and encourage coordination among agencies and the courts. My item number six is similar or identical to Donna Silverberg's suggestion in terms of some amendments to Section 9. The issue here is how disputes are resolved over the funding. Part of the function of the program is to manage the grant funds and protect the public interest there. And so what this does is to ensure that there is some mechanism if a director needs to act immediately to protect the public interest and recover funds, that there is a way to do that, albeit there are opportunities to mediate and negotiate where things are less severe. My item number seven is a slight variation on the theme on Donna's suggestion to require an advisory committee. What I suggest here is that there be a advisory committee created specifically for the purposes of developing policy and for rulemaking, which is a function that in order, I think, for the school to have legitimacy, they're going to need to have an advisory body that's helping them on this, on these rulemaking functions and policy setting. And at the same time, as Mr. Taylor pointed out, encouraging or leaving open that opportunity for other advisory committees. I, in terms of continuity, I recommend here that the current commissioners be grandfathered in into that initial advisory committee to provide continuity in that program transition. That's a recommendation that I make. And further, I also suggest that the language be put back in that allows for some compensation of advisory committee members for transportation costs. Otherwise, the program up at Portland State is going to find it pretty tough to get representation from community programs down in Medford. So I'd recommend that get put back in. My number eight, I suggest the director of the Hatfield School be added into Section 25. What this does is just makes it clear that the program has a role in coordinating public policy, state agency, ADR, as our program currently does. At number 10, state agencies shall seek to identify cases. I think this recommendation goes back to the original intent in that state agencies should be encouraged to look for alternative ways to resolve disputes. And so those are my recommended edits. I'd be happy to respond to any questions or thoughts you have.
Questions? There are none.
Okay.
Thank you. We've got someone, I'm not sure the name of it, the gentleman from Willamette University. Or is it?
Rich Burke.
Rich Burke.
Okay. Chairman, this is members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity. It has been not until today that I became aware of the very real possibility that the Dispute Resolution Commission might have a chance of being relocated at any number of private institutions. And so it's been until today that I've had a chance to think about this and get clearance internally. And I found that my dean is not only willing to have the commission at our school, but willing to do whatever it takes to have the commission at Willamette. We have the oldest, best-established dispute resolution center, I believe, on the West Coast. We've been in existence for more than 20 years. The law school has staked its reputation at various times on being a leader in dispute resolution. Since the U.S. News and World Report started publishing its rankings of dispute resolution programs, we've always been in the top 10. The school is now focusing on dispute resolution in a new way. There are some programs that we have yet to announce and roll out, but this has been a rebuilding summer as we have a large number of new faculty members. We have an open clinical position, and there's been a renewed interest in dispute resolution at Willamette. The advantages, I believe, of a private institution are many. In particular, the main two are that the university's financial structure is very, very nimble, and it would be easy for us to incorporate a state entity into our financial structure without having to really rewrite much in the way of bylaws. We have a track record of doing that with respect to the Oregon Law Commission. I believe that your work with Dave Kanagi and Wendy Johnson would suggest that it's been a very smooth transition between the public and private partnership there. In the 10 years that I've been the director of the Center for Dispute Resolution, I've worked with all four of the commission directors, starting with Alice Vail, and I have a terrific relationship and have employed many of my students as interns at the Dispute Resolution Commission. So I have a good sense of what the programs are and how they would mesh with Willamette. I'm not today looking to have you decide to place the program at Willamette. I would expect that you need more information from me before that decision could be made. And I am, like my colleagues, more than amenable to looking at collaborative possibilities among various higher ed institutions. I would, however, like to urge you to keep Willamette in your consideration as being part or a primary member of that mix. One advantage that we have that no place else can claim is our location relative to state government and our history of working well with state government. With that, I'll take any questions that you might have.
Questions?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I find it curious that the oldest, possibly best respected facility or program in the Northwest wasn't contacted in some sort of an outreach when it became clear that the dispute resolution program might be moving. So I just wonder, apparently the other institutions were somehow contacted or became aware of the issue, but now that the information is available, I would expect that Willamette would be included in the mix for contemplation of where to move this program.
All right. Other comments? I think what I'm going to do is chat with a co-chair regarding his objective and what he's trying to accomplish, because I think they introduced this bill with the idea that they would save some money. And my observation is that there are a lot of interested parties for any number of reasons, either having the program housed at their school. I assume the objective is to expand the program, expand the use of dispute resolution. And what I'm thinking right now is that we're not going to be able to solve this problem in the short period of time that we have between now and presumably the end of the session. So I want to try to see if I can figure out whether or not we ought to look at some interim solution that we will allow the legislature to save money for this biennium. But, and I'm thinking out loud here, in essence, abolishing this dispute resolution commission at the end of the biennium, allow them to do the reduced budget, but require that they come back at some point with a plan for where this should be housed in the future and report to the interim judiciary committee with some plan. There's a lot of smart people in the room, but when you have different institutions, private and public, I think rightfully so, arguing amongst themselves, and argument would not be the right word, where this should be housed, it's very difficult for us to intervene and make that choice. Now, I'll throw that out there. That's what I'm thinking right now. Someone else may have a more brilliant idea, but this is one of those issues that appears to me to be like a snowball that gathers more snow as it goes down the hill. It's more complex.
Well,
so,
Mr. Chairman, I'm more optimistic than that. I think we can figure out a way to keep this wonderful functional life. We have really strong programs out there, and I'm more optimistic than that.
Wonderful.
Chairman, Senator Ferriola, may I respond just to one comment? I want to make it clear, nobody, I believe, kept us out of the loop, and we were always aware of the steps that were being made to relocate the commission. However, things moved very, very quickly, and as I said, it was more a accident of timing that I became aware that this was the opportunity came. I don't mean to create the impression that we were not included in a conversation.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with Senator Burdick. I think we can resolve this matter, but I would also encourage you, if you have the thought that we can't resolve this matter before the end of session, that we not abolish the commission, that we suspend it as was recommended, because once you abolish it, it's gone, and nobody cares about bringing it back again. So I do think the parties can work this through, and we can find a solution that might work. And if we can't, then I would recommend suspension rather than abolishing.
Senator Ferriola.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think the interest that's been demonstrated by a wide variety of institutions is very encouraging, and I think it's a demonstration that dispute resolution has an increasingly important role to play in society. I think that's very clear by the interest that I think that people have demonstrated. It's all essentially building for the future, and I think that's in recognition that it's going to get more important. I would like to see a discussion or even a work group among the institutions that allows them to all answer the same set of questions. Why do they think, or which institution should be considered statewide? How the public-private base of those institutions might affect their ability or the perception of their ability to do the work, what assets they have currently, what assets they'll bring to this program, and then in summary, the strongest argument each institution can make for the housing of this institution. And I don't necessarily think this is a bone of contention between the institutions, but I think the competition for this program would be a healthy thing. And it would perhaps allow us to make a choice that would be based on the best long-term commitment to the program. And I think that has the best potential for saving general fund dollars. But I'd like at least to see what the institutions are willing to commit long-term to have this program.
Senator Starr?
I appreciate very much Senator Perioli's appraisal of what we've been hearing. I think we do need more information in order to make a judgment. I too am disinclined to abolish, and I think suspension is a much better route to travel. And so I think as long as we're in the business, the state's business here, that we should pursue some solution here rather than just letting it off at this point.
All right. I didn't want to have to use my heavy hand, but I guess I will.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're a mediator.
Well, I think I'm it. Who wants to play ball in this game here? Mr. Wolf wants to play. The University of Oregon Law School team, Ms. Gordon, wants to play. You want to play? Mr. Taylor's going to play. And who else? The lady from the dispute.
Silverberg.
And Ms. Silverberg. Thank you very much. All right. Who else has an interest? They'll just be totally ticked off if they're not part of this whole thing. Who are you and who do you represent? All right, you guys figure out among yourself who gets to represent CDRC, but only one of you. All right, and have an answer by next Wednesday. Okay, Bill, you facilitate it.
I'd be glad to, Mr. Chair. Maybe some better guidance should we find out from Ways and Means or whatever, what kind of money they're talking about, and then going from there.
Find out what the target reduction is.
Right. And then what each school is willing to do with that money individually or collectively.
And I guess what I would hope is I think this program is extremely important. I think there's a tremendous opportunity to expand the program with a collaborative approach. I just am not in a position that I want to pick University of Oregon versus Portland State versus Washington. I think it's best for them to sit down and try to figure out how that should function, because I think it should be built on a foundation of growing the program in a collaborative environment, and I think bringing in public-private partnerships in the business community and others and leveraging private funds would make a lot of sense. So that's my little thing here for Senator Burdick. I don't want to cut Senator Walker out. I guess Senator Walker and Senator Ferrioli, you guys can participate if you want. You can all participate, just don't make a quorum and make a decision.
That's right.
All right, as far as I'm concerned. But Wednesday afternoon, we either have a solution or we don't.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I will get everyone's name, address, and email number, and we'll meet tomorrow, the first of next week.
Right, first of next week.
Okay.
You all think over the weekend, email each other and stuff, and, you know, figure out what you can do. How's that for dispute resolution?
Thanks, John.
Excellent.